And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine. In 1913, the U.S. government helped facilitate Buffalo Bill Cody's epic film about the final battles between Native Americans and the U.S. cavalry. But after they watched it, the movie disappeared. The Strange Saga of Buffalo Bill's The Indian Wars by David Hofstede. It was an idea born not so much from inspiration as desperation. Beginning in 1883, William F. Buffalo Bill Cody's famed Wild West stage spectacular had been playing to the sold-out audiences around the world. The show featured historical legends such as Sitting Bull and sharpshooter Annie Oakley, and included dramatic reenactments of Pony Express rides, an attack on the Deadwood stagecoach, and a spectacular grand finale with buffalo, elk, deer, wild horses, and steers stampeding with cowboys and Indians. But by 1913, the crowds began to dwindle, and Cody was forced to declare bankruptcy and auction off props from the show. Audiences had turned to a new form of entertainment, silent films, and here the famed showman saw an opportunity for financial recovery. Cody was no stranger to movies, having appeared in several short films through an association with Thomas Edison that began shortly after the inventor introduced moving pictures. But this time, he knew that only something bigger and more extravagant would generate the profit he needed. After securing a $50,000 investment from the SNA Film Manufacturing Company and the owners of the Denver Post and Kansas City Post newspapers, Cody approached the United States government with an idea to shoot historical reenactments of the last battles fought between the United States troops and Native Americans. "My object and desire," he told the magazine, Moving Picture World, "has been to preserve history by the aid of camera with as many of the living participants in the closing Indian Wars of North America as could be procured. It is something that has never been done before, that is, to preserve our old wars for future generations." A chronicle of the correspondence between Cody, his investors, and the U.S. government has been preserved in the archives of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. On August 24, 1913, Cody wrote to Secretary of War Lindley M. Garrison for access to South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where the Battle of Wounded Knee was fought. Cody told him that General Frank Baldwin, who was present at that surrender, has promised to take part in the work, and we expect also that General Nelson A. Miles will cooperate. In a letter to Secretary of the Interior Franklin K. Lane, a representative of Cody's investors expressed his belief that everything will be done to ensure the future generation a most worthy document of a great event which has few of its distinguished participants left to tell the story. The film, according to promotional advertising, would recreate the battles of Summit Springs, 1869, and War Bonnet Creek, 1876, both of which Cody participated in as an Army scout, and conclude at Pine Ridge with the Battle of Wounded Knee, all of which would be shot at their original battle locations. Surviving footage and records, however, can only verify that on-location filming took place between September 1913 and October 1913 in the Badlands of South Dakota and the Black Hills of Wyoming. Garrison supplied Cody with troops from the 12th U.S. Cavalry, and Lane authorized the participation of more than 1,000 Sioux Indians. Lieutenant General Nelson Appleton Miles was hired as a technical consultant to make sure that the reenactments were as accurate as possible. The movie also featured depictions of the campaign of the Ghost Dance, or Messiah Craze War, and the capture of Chief Bigfoot. The final scenes showed tribes acclimating to Western ways, with children attending modern schools and Indian farmers bringing in their crops. After filming ended, Cody wrote to his attorney, Clarence W. Rowley, that he had just returned from the taking of over 4 miles of the greatest motion pictures ever taken. He reported that offers for exhibition were arriving not only from all over America, but from Great Britain and Europe for these pictures. It may be that we will first produce them in Washington, D.C., then Madison Square Garden, New York, Boston, and all the large cities before putting them on the market. In a separate letter, he related that SNA co-founder George Spoor remarked that these pictures would be the best money getters of any movies ever produced. Cody was set to receive 1/3 of the profits. I think I am in line here. At least all the moving pictures, people think so, to make a lot of money yet this winter. The next few months were spent editing the 2.5-hour film, now titled The Indian Wars. We will show them first to President Woodrow Wilson, Secretaries of War and Interior, General Miles, and others, as well as foreign ambassadors, and budget their endorsements. Then they will be more valuable, Cody wrote to Wyoming Senator Jake Schwoob in December of 1913. We've been offered big money, but Mr. Spoor advises, hold until we get the endorsements, then sell all foreign rights, showing in high-priced houses first, then the 5x10-cent houses, and Spoor says, don't get nervous. We will soon have all kinds of money coming. The screening Cody referenced was held at the White House on February 26, 1914. Shortly thereafter, Cody traveled to Denver for a lecture to accompany a week-long exhibition of the film at the Tabor Opera House. The film did turn away business and was equally popular at a screening in Omaha. According to the Omaha World Herald on March 17, 1914, the theater had been filled to capacity for both showings. But after the Omaha screening, during which Cody reported the film was a hit that could play for 5 weeks, the archives at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West provide no further mentions of later exhibitions or public reception. A movie that stirred tremendous confidence in its significance and profit potential just vanished. Did the U.S. government suppress the Indian War? That was the assertion of Ben Black Elk, whose father, Black Elk, was in the movie. It was made exactly as it happened, Ben Black Elk said in an interview with historian William S.E. Coleman about the depiction of Wounded Knee. Do you know what happened to that motion picture? The government put a ban on it. A friend went to Washington, D.C. to see the movie, but they had destroyed it. Their conversation is recounted in The War, The West, and The Wilderness, written by silent film historian Kevin Brownlow. Brownlow added that there were contrary opinions regarding how the battle was depicted, but concluded it cannot be denied that Cody's film was given short shrift by the government and that it apparently decomposed at the Bureau of Indian Affairs sometime in the 20s. It typically takes 40 years or more for nitrate film to decompose, so it is unlikely that it happened so quickly on this one film, one for which no other print has been found. Today, historians categorize Wounded Knee more as a massacre than a battle, and if Cody had indeed depicted it there would be good reason for the government to not want the film widely screened. I don't know if I could draw a firm conclusion, but it's fairly interesting. And certainly the government was up to its neck in the film because they provided both troops and allowed the Indians to participate. So they had some leverage, says Paul Hutton, a professor of history at the University of New Mexico, who delivered the keynote address about Cody at a symposium hosted by the Buffalo Bills Center of the West. He also acknowledged that Cody was such a patriot, so whatever the government said, he would go along. The key figure in this mystery may be General Miles, who was against the filming of the Wounded Knee battle from the start. He viewed the conflict as unwarranted and unjustifiable and saw no benefit in recreating it. I am decidedly of the opinion that this is not in the public interest or for the welfare of the Indians to have such exhibition presented. Cody had feuded with General Miles toward the end of making the movie, and Miles stormed off in a huff, so who knows what Miles, who could be really prickly, was up to. He was out of the army by that time, but still would have had some influence, Hutton says. The edict could also have come directly from President Wilson, who understood the power and propaganda potential in motion pictures. After watching D.W. Griffith's Civil War-era epic, Birth of a Nation, he pronounced it history written with lightning. Given how that film depicted the Ku Klux Klan as a heroic force, Wilson apparently preferred a non-nuanced depiction of the past. There was no hint of official disapproval, Brownlow writes, of the government's response to the Indian Wars, yet the government held the film back from release. Cody spoke out for fair treatment of Indians as far back as 1872, when that was not a popular opinion. He had a lot of sympathy for the Sioux and other tribes, and he knew so many of these people because they had been in his show. Riley Cooper, a reporter dispatched by the Denver Post to cover the film's production, wrote of conversations heard among the troops that expressed admiration and sympathy for the Sioux, and anger over the fact that their own government rarely honored the terms of any treaty with the Indians. Cooper was equally resolute in characterizing the Wounded Knee conflict. There, the white man was the aggressor. They far outnumbered the Indians. The red men were crowded down into a ravine where lines of bullets sent them to death in scores. But Jeremy Johnston, managing editor of the Papers of William F. Cody at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West, is not as certain that conspiracy is to blame for the film's disappearance. I haven't seen anything that would lead me to believe that the government would take that kind of action because they were upset about the content. One of Buffalo Bill's attributes was he really understood his audience, and he would have played up to that. He would not have produced something that would have made American audiences uncomfortable about the government policy toward Indians. He acknowledges the tensions between Cody and Miles, but attributes them more to Miles' insistence on attention to detail, causing the film to run over schedule and over budget. He also doesn't view the death of communication regarding the film's fate in the archive as evidence of intrigue. One thing to keep in mind, and this is frustrating when it comes to understanding Buffalo Bill and his legacy, is that in some cases we have very deep pools of archival information, but in other areas the pools are dry. What we have is just a small fraction of an archive that has long been scattered. So what happened to the Indian Wars? I know there's been a lot of speculation about what has happened to this supposed masterpiece, Johnston says. In my opinion, I think the weakness of the film was you have this aging Western figure playing himself as a young man, and it doesn't work. You look at the little footage that's left, it's not the young Buffalo Bill that the public envisioned participating in all these conflicts. I think that was one of the biggest flaws of the project. A negative audience reaction would certainly explain the film not playing longer, but it appears most of the public never had a chance to judge for themselves. Much of the speculation would be clarified if we had a copy of the film, but only a few minutes survived at the Buffalo Bill Center. The only other references to the Indian Wars in their archive begin in 1915, when a clerk in the Department of Interior dispatched a series of letters to Cody requesting a print of the film for the department's collection. This correspondence ends in March of 1916, with the film still not delivered. Perhaps Cody was concerned it would suffer the same fate as the one previously sent to the War Department. According to Kevin Brownlow, the Indian Wars was revived after Cody died in 1917, together with veiled remarks about the government's attempts to suppress it. After that, the trail runs cold. That same year, the U.S. had entered World War I, and the Wilson administration had joined forces with studios such as Universal and Vitagraph to promote propaganda films in support of the war effort. Whatever its defects, whatever its inaccuracies, the Indian Wars would represent a historical prize of immense value, if only it could be found, Brownlow writes. The search for this extraordinary film should not be abandoned. In the bunkhouse with Red Steagall and country music legend Larry Gatlin. Red Steagall. Larry, I want the folks to know where you came from, where your family came from, what your background is. Larry Gatlin. Well, Dad was born in East Texas, and his father was a sharecropper. His mother passed away when he was 15 with tuberculosis. His father was kind of sick and puny most of his life. Bless his heart, Dad went to the war, was actually in the USS Wakefield on his way for the invasion of Japan, when Harry Truman had the wherewithal to do what was needed to be done. Came home, married Mama. A couple of years later, I was born, and he was a driller out in the oil field, and we moved around a lot. Finally kind of parked there in Odessa, went to Odessa High School. Everybody, when they hear about Odessa, they say, well, Permian and the Mighty Mojo, Friday. Well, I'm 2-1 against him, the only quarterback in history 2-1 against Mojo. But the brothers and I sing, that's that side of the family. And Mom's side of the family. Our mom is a Done. We are direct line descendants of John Donne, the great English poet. No man is an island. And Deacon Done and that family is actually the largest documented family in America. So Done's Pills, Done College, Done's Crossing Up on the Red River. And Papa was a great singer. The day he passed away, he could sing. He had a high B flat, just like a bell. Taught us to sing out of the old shape notes, stamps, Baxter songbooks. We grew up singing in church, listening to the great gospel singers, the Blackwood Brothers, the Chuck Wagon Gang, the Statesman Quartet. And it's just been our love, and it came natural to us. We never knew anything different. So I come from good stock, from good, God-fearing people who worked hard and taught Steve and Rudy and me to work hard. And that, like I say, that legacy that our papa worked for Sinclair Oil Company for 50 years and having the last name Done, D-O-A-N. In the 20s and 30s, during the Teapot Dome scandal with Harry Sinclair, Papa worked for Sinclair. So everybody started calling him Teapot. The guy who preached his funeral said, well, that old boy, that casket right there, that ain't Cliff Done, that's Teapot Done right there. Hard work, clean living. We come from good stock, and I'm grateful during all the epidemics and things. I mean, you're lucky if you can choose your ancestors.
Cowboys and Indians contributors. Santa Fe resident Johnny D. Boggs, Influential Indigenous, page 90, received the 2020 Owen Wister Award for Lifetime Contributions to Western Literature and was inducted into the Western Writers Hall of Fame. Winner of a record 9 Spur Awards from Western Writers of America for his fiction, the former newspaper journalist contributes nonfiction to many magazines and has written several film history books. His website is johnnydboggs.com. Heidi Brandis, A Hero for All Times, page 96, is an award-winning writer and journalist based in Oklahoma City. She loves tackling stories about her home state, but also writes about culture, travel, business, history, and quirky adventures for numerous national and international publications. She is an avid traveler, a member of both the Society of American Travel Writers and the North American Travel Journalists Association, and currently serves as president of the Society of Professional Journalists Oklahoma Pro Chapter. Her adventures and stories can be found at HeidiBrandis.com. Dave Hofstedt, Dean Martin's Country and Cowboy Legacy, page 108, has been a regular contributor to Cowboys and Indians since 1999. He is also a TV historian and pop culture enthusiast who has written 15 books on classic films and television. He lives in Henderson, Nevada. Austin-based home and garden writer Laura Costelny, A Family's Cabin Legacy, page 74, began knocking on doors and asking people about their decor long before her career began 25 years ago. She maintains that every home she's ever toured has come with at least one surprise, and a wallpaper choice says way more about a person than an astrological sign ever could. In this issue, Laura writes about a dreamy Washington Lake house that noted architect Jim Olson has been perfecting for more than 60 years. Miante Metcalf McConnell, The Real Mary Fields, page 118, is a creative whose pursuits of expression fall within the realm of multidisciplinary arts. Professions during an eventful career include visual artist, photographer, graphic designer, textile art design, and production, writer, and perpetual entrepreneur. A descendant of early Montana homesteaders, Miante spends most of her childhood on the back of a horse, yearning to reach the highest Bitterroot Mountain's peak. Today, she has completed a nonfiction biography of Mary Fields, writing a memoir-based novel, illustrating a children's picture book, and reading the same trail. Bo Simmons, Mojave, page 114, is a photographer who specializes in medium and large format film photography. After making his name in celebrity fashion photography, Bo developed a passion for capturing forgotten ways of life. His latest project highlights 21st century combat veterans, culminating in a thorough and compassionate documentation in the book, The 20-Year War. Bo's artworks were represented by multiple art galleries in Los Angeles, Dallas, and Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is Michael, and I'm reading an article from the True West Archives, July 1988 edition. The Fremont Street Fiasco, or How to Start a Legend Without Really Trying, by Gary L. Roberts. By almost any measure, those 30 seconds of bloody mayhem called Gunfight at the OK Corral were insignificant in American history. They marked no watershed in the national epoch. They hardly caused a ripple on the troubled waters of westward expansion. But, incredibly, that violent footnote is the most celebrated, the most controversial gunfight in Western history. At the hands of popular writers, the shootout has achieved unequaled importance as a symbol of the contest for law and order on the old frontier. It has even invited scholarly investigation as a case study in frontier violence. So while it probably made little difference in the course of Arizona history, it has profoundly affected our image of the West. That in itself is amazing, and it must mean that something about the episode is important. But what is more amazing is how seriously most of those who have sought to tell the story of the Earp Clanton gunfight take their subject, and how determined most have been to tell the story in classic good guys and bad guys style. The sour-faced, mean-spirited partnership that has marked most writing on the subject almost suggests that if you want to understand Western history, you have to start at the OK Corral. Although, if you had been there that blustery afternoon of October 26th, 1881, you would have missed the fight, which actually took place over on Fremont Street. Most published accounts do not help very much. There is, my okay, you're okay, everybody's okay. When you read about Wyatt Earp You must either enjoy yourself reading about a character who is too good to be true, or wade through incoherent and inarticulate ramblings to discover that Earp really was not worth the trouble. Walter Noble Burns, Stuart N. Lake, and a host of latter-day followers have characterized the street fight as the classic showdown between law and outlaw, with Wyatt Earp as the preeminent peace officer of the Old West. Frank Waters, Ed Bartholomew, Odie Falk, and others have cast the episode as a cold-blooded and premeditated multiple murder. Some more recent writers have a more balanced view, but on occasion a few of them have combined their discovery of important new materials with a seemingly uncontrollable urge to invent evidence to fill in the gaps. And since most of these documents are in private collections, distinguishing between legitimate sources and fraudulent ones is nearly impossible. The supporters of all viewpoints have varied in sophistication, in attention to the historical record, and in respect for high standards of research. But oddly, they have shared the same basic assumption, a childlike faith that the shootout on Fremont Street can be explained in terms of right and wrong. On the one hand, the gunfight was the result of murderous threats by a gang of cutthroats who were then shot while resisting arrest. On the other, the massacre was the slaughter of innocent cowboys, or rivals in crime in some variations, by the malign and corrupt Earps. Both make interesting reading, and both can be defended with more or less success, which only proves that you can prove anything you want to prove if you manipulate the evidence. The trouble is that the assumption that the famed shootout was a simple matter of right and wrong is a very large one. Just possibly the events of that October afternoon were more complex than either scenario allows. Maybe the Earps were not good guys or bad guys, but just plain guys, ambitious guys, angry guys, guys more than a little rough around the edges, but still guys with both faults and virtues. If the Clantons and McClurys, too, were just plain guys, then the possible scenarios multiply. Not even deciding that one side had the weight of right on their side in the overall situation in Tombstone, and I believe the Earps did, resolves the issue. Good men, after all, sometimes act out of anger and stupidity and frustration and just plain vindictiveness, completely convinced that they are doing the right thing. And bad men do not always plan the mischief they get into, even when they provoke it. So concluding that the Earps or the Clantons were right does not automatically justify or condemn or explain the behavior of either group in the particular events of October 26, 1881. Still, making judgments about the state of affairs in Tombstone and the character of the participants creates a predisposition to believe one side or the other. If the Earps were responsible officers representing the interests of the law-abiding community, believing that they could murder anyone becomes difficult. And if the Clantons were just harmless cattlemen unjustly accused of criminal activity, declaring them to be outlaws seems unfair. At Tombstone, what people believed to be true was more important than whatever was true. And the same thing can be said of all the folks who have since written about what happened there. In life and in history, people act on their perceptions of reality. So, if you read the accounts of the fight, you are confronted with a mass of contradictory opinions, testimony, and interpretations, which strongly suggest that somebody did not tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, in justice of the peace Wells Spicer's court during the month of November 1881. You face four alternatives. One, the Clantons were lying and at fault. Two, the Earps were lying and at fault. Three, everybody was lying with enough fault all around to disgust the most jaded buff. Or four, nobody was lying. Now, if you believe the hero worshippers, you will conclude that the Clantons were lying. If you are convinced by the debunkers, you will swear the ERPs were lying. If you read very much of the literature, you will probably conclude that there were enough congenial liars in Tombstone that autumn to have filled a regiment. But after fooling with this subject for nearly 30 years, I have concluded that nobody was lying. That puts me in a worse position than the Clantons or McClories were in at the gunfight, or at least sets me up as a likely recipient of the Ned Buntline Award for the most far-fetched idea since Colonel Nichols got hold of Wild Bill Hickok in 1867. Still, you ought to give me a fair trial before you hang me. The whole approach rests squarely on the assumption that everybody told the truth as they understood the truth through the blinders of their own interests, preconceptions, emotions, and prejudices. I don't suggest that either side was incapable of prevarication or twisting things to suit themselves. Efforts to make the Clantons and McClories and the bunch of cutthroats they call friends just good old boys simply will not wash. Virtually every one of them ended up killed or in jail, and Wyatt Earp's penchant for creative reminiscing, especially in his later years, is too well documented to merit debate. I suggest that the Earp-Clanton street fight has perplexed those who have studied it because the most celebrated gunfight in Western history was not planned at all, not by the Clantons or by the Earps. Rather, the shootout was an accident, the product of a series of stupid, almost comic blunders. Hot tempers, pride, whiskey, orneriness, and the interference of some well-meaning busybodies produced the result that everybody blustered about, but nobody really wanted. Far from the stuff of legend, the Fremont Street gunfight was a surprisingly predictable product of human behavior and a testimony to the monumental stupidity of the human race. And much of the participants' confusion about the events derived from the simple fact that they themselves did not know exactly what happened. Wyatt Earp always said that the fight was bound to happen sooner or later, and he may have been right. There were certainly enough causes for bad feelings between the two groups. From the first, the Earps and the Cowboys rubbed each other raw. The Sam Simon Cowboys had things their own way until the Earps, a brood of black-suited Yankees, arrived, manipulating business interests, gobbling up official positions, and cultivating friends among the better element of Tombstone society. The officious, sometimes arrogant, and always superior attitude of the Earps rankled the Cowboys, and several episodes, like the stealing of some army mules and the killing of Marshal Fred White, kept the animosities growing. But the thing that really blew the relationship sky high was the cozy little deal between Wyatt Earp and Ike Clanton concerning the robbery of the Benson stage in March 1881. The known thieves were friends of Ike's, and Wyatt knew it. Wyatt also wanted to be sheriff of Cochise County, so he approached Ike with a proposition. If Ike would play Judas and betray the robbers to Wyatt, good old Wyatt would give him the reward. All Wyatt wanted was the glory. Never a man to pass up an opportunity to make a buck without having to work for it, Ike agreed. He would be a good deal richer, and Wyatt would be a shoe-in for sheriff. Unfortunately, the deal never came off. The stage robbers did not cooperate and got themselves killed before Ike had a chance to betray them. That left both Ike and Wyatt with an embarrassing secret. Still, it might not have caused a problem if Wyatt had not made the mistake of telling his little secret to Marshal Williams, the local Wells Fargo agent. Williams, who could not keep his mouth shut about anything, promptly told Ike what he knew. Ike, already feeling guilty about his poor departed friends, blew his stack. If there was anyone in Tombstone who did not already know about the deal, Ike soon fixed that as he thundered from one saloon to the next, taking on booze and letting off steam. Needless to say, the affair did not endear Wyatt to Ike. nor did it help Wyatt's reputation among the good folks of Tombstone. If any one man was responsible for the Fremont street gun battle, Ike Clanton was the man. He was a braggart and a coward. He was outclassed by the Earps and he knew it. But to keep up appearances, he had to take the offensive. And he was offensive. On October 25th, 1881, Ike showed up in Tombstone along with Tom McClory. As usual, he was talking big, overly aggressive, and drinking heavily. Drunk, Ike figured he was a match for anyone, and he foolishly attempted to beat the Earps at their own game, in this case, poker. That evening, a strange group gathered around a green-topped table. Virgil Earp, the town marshal, and John Behan, the local sheriff, thought to be too close to the Clantons for the county's good, were joined by Morgan Earp and John H. Doc Holliday for a friendly game. Later in the evening, Ike Clanton and Tom McClory showed up and were allowed politely to contribute their pokes to the largesse on the table. Somehow, for the moment, the competitive spirit of the two factions was confined to poker. And the evening went smoothly, until Virgil took off his overcoat. When he did, he removed a revolver from the coat's pocket and placed it on his lap. That set off Ike, who told Virg in no uncertain terms that he did not need a gun to play poker. Sheriff Behan brought matters back to more important things, and the boys were soon concentrating on their cards again. By the time the game broke up in the early morning hours, Ike's pockets had been cleaned. As they left the saloon, Ike, on the one hand, and Morgan Earp and Doc Holliday, on the other, exchanged opinions about each other's pedigrees and evaluated one another's manhood. Morgan soon wearied of the exchange, but Ike and Doc carried the argument with them into a restaurant across the street, where they raised such a ruckus that Virgil had to go quiet them. He told Doc to drop the matter, and Holliday left. Ike then turned on Virgil, railing at him first about Holliday, and then about Virgil himself and that damned pistol in his lap during the poker game. The weary marshal left him there, still grumbling, and went home for some peace and quiet. Ike should have done the same. Instead, after fortifying himself with even more of Tombstone's liquors, he threatened the Earps with a frequency that made him a damned nuisance. With Winchester in hand, he roamed the streets announcing that the ball would open when the Earps showed their faces. At 9 o'clock in the morning on October 26th, one of the local policemen banged on Virgil Earp's door and told him that Ike was making threats all over town. With his brothers Wyatt and Morgan, Virgil went looking for him, while Wyatt checked out the saloons. Virgil and Morgan almost collided with Ike on the street. Virgil unceremoniously cracked him over the head with a revolver and hauled him into the justice's court. Even there, with his head still bleeding, Clanton spewed invective like a ruptured sewer line. Morgan, who was not noted for his self-restraint, offered to oblige him in his oft-repeated demand for 4 feet of ground. Tom McClory, who heard about Ike's binge over breakfast, bumped into Wyatt Earp outside the courtroom, and Wyatt, for no more logical reason than anger, laid him in the gutter with a barrel of his big nickel-plated Smith & Wesson. Such treatment was enough to take the starch out of most men, and since easygoing Tom was like most men, he had his head bandaged and then deposited his pistol at Andy Meehan's saloon to avoid trouble. When Frank McClory and young Bill Clanton rode into Tombstone looking for their brothers, they found them at the Grand Hotel. There, they listened quietly and with increasing anger to Ike's doubtlessly self-serving account for the treatment he had received at the hands of the Earps. The bandage on Tom McClory's head was enough to send Frank into a rage, and he now seemed to take charge. They left the hotel for Dexter's livery stable, discussing what should happen to the Earps with appropriate epithets and descriptive language. If talk normally is cheap, then Tombstone was suffering with runaway inflation that day. To make matters worse, the town had more than its share of good citizens who promptly hurried off to tell Marshal Earp and egg a good fight. More than likely, it was angry but essential idle chatter, and Marshal Earp hoped that the Clantons and McClories would just leave town. But everywhere the Earp's boys went, some well-intentioned local was on hand to report the latest rumor. So that as the gossip spread through the town, the threats took on a more ominous ring. After a while, the Earps probably lost count of the tales they heard, but enough choice obscenities and profanities had been sprinkled around town to have infuriated the Pope. Ike Clanton had a big mouth, but then everybody in Tombstone knew that, and while Virgil's temper was boiling, he, if not Wyatt and Morgan, still figured that Ike's threats were all wind. If anything gave Virgil a reason to worry, it was that Frank McClory was in town, stone cold sober and mad as hell. That was enough to keep the Earps on their guard. They were patient, and the day wore on with a strange pantomime as the cowboys bristled past the Earps, armed to the teeth and glaring at Virg and Wyatt and Morgan, while the Earps stared back from beneath their broad-brimmed hats, their jaws set hard, and their eyes cold and determined. They were, all of them, like little boys trying to look tough on the first day of school. Eventually, the Clantons and the McClories marched into G.F. Spangenberg's gun shop, where they made a big show of buying ammunition and loading their weapons in plain view for the benefit of Wyatt and Virg across the street. Wyatt almost precipitated a fight on the spot when, at Virgil's command, he stalked across the street and ordered Frank McClory to get his blankety-blanked horse off the sidewalk. Fortunately, Virg was nearby, and his icy stare and the 10-gauge sawed-off shotgun in the crook of his arm dampened the ardor of the cowboys, who seemed just about ready to take Wyatt on for questioning their right to park wherever they pleased. The Earps watched silently as the cowboys left the gun shop and proceeded to the Dexter livery stable, where they secured two additional horses before crossing the street to the OK Corral and disappearing into its huge stable. Maybe, just maybe, they had had enough and were going to leave town. The Earps then entered Hafford's saloon and were joined by Doc Holliday, who ironically had just shaken hands with Billy Clanton a few minutes earlier outside the Grand Hotel, and by Sheriff Ian, who had interrupted a shave down the street to see what he could do about the situation. While they were talking, several locals eagerly reported what they had seen and heard. Johnny Bean hustled off to confer with the boys before things got out of hand. Virgil, not Wyatt, was the stabilizing force among the Earp brothers. His calm, deliberate manner often restrained Morgan's temper and Wyatt's ambition. He was slow to anger, and so far he had kept his cool. But when J.L. Franck and W.B. Murray told him that the Clantons and McClurys had left the OK Corral and were waiting for them in a vacant lot on Fremont Street, near 3rd, he decided the moment had come to do something. Franck and Murray had offered to assemble a party of citizens to go with him, but Virg told them to stay clear. It was his responsibility as town marshal to arrest the Clanton bunch. A brief council was held, Doc Holliday offered to help, and Virg accepted his offer. He then handed Doc the sawed-off 10-gauge shotgun he was toting and took Doc's cane. He saw no need to have that cannon in sight, so Doc hid it under his overcoat. The wind was cold as they started toward Fremont Street. Meanwhile, Johnny Bean had found the cowboys on the vacant lot next to C.S. Fly's photography studio on Fremont Street. Ike was still talking big. Tom McClory's head was still hurting. Frank McClory had calmed down some, and he was ready to get his brother back to their Sulphur Springs ranch, or so he said. Young Billy Clanton said he just wanted to go home. After all, he and Frank so far had done nothing to be arrested for. Bill Claiborne and Wes Fuller, two small-timers who enjoyed the excitement kept egging things on. But Ben was soon convinced that the boys were finally settling down. For all his bragging, Ike was not even armed, or so he told the sheriff, which showed poor judgment if that was true. At that point, the Earps came into view, walking briskly up Fremont Street, just like in the movies. The cowboys braced themselves, determined not to back down now, while Ben made a beeline for the Earps. As the Earps walked up the street, they spoke among themselves and probably swore with appropriate epithets, as several eyewitnesses said that they did, that the sons of bitches could have all the fight they wanted. When he reached them, Ben told the Earps that the boys were leaving town, that they were unarmed, and that they had taken care of things. The Earps never broke stride. They were relieved by what Ben had said, but they were also skeptical. Besides, things had gone too far simply to break off their errand without losing face. As they walked on, Ben shouted after them, "Don't go down there!" When the Earps reached the vacant lot and moved into position with Virgil in the lead, followed by Wyatt and Morgan, Doc Holliday hung back on the edge of Fremont Street. The adversaries were jammed between two buildings in a space not more than 20 feet across. The Earps faced the Clantons and McClurys scarcely 6 feet away. Frank McClury was in the center, slightly in front of the others. Behind him, Billy Clanton, Ike Clanton, Tom McClory, Wes Fuller, and Bill Claiborne lined up. The moment of truth had arrived. Virgil stepped forward, raising his cane in his gun hand, high above his head, and said in his most authoritative voice, "Throw up your hands!" Some eyewitnesses said later that they heard someone, they thought one of the Earps, say, "Kill the sons of bitches!" Others claimed that Frank McClory looked at Billy Clanton and said, "We will." "We will what? Throw up our hands? Kill the sons of bitches? Fight for our lives?" Whatever he meant, the Clanton partisans always insisted that the boys did throw up their hands, while the Earps maintained that the cowboys threw down on them. The testimony suggests a third alternative. For a terrifying moment, the Clantons and McClurys were paralyzed with indecision. Then one of them made his move. Poor old Tom. He never could follow instructions. The man had said plain as day, "Throw up your hands." So what did Tom do? He grabbed his lapels and threw open his coat to show that he was unarmed. His friend said later, "Maybe, but when Wyatt saw his hands sweep back and pull his coat away from his waist, he interpreted the movement differently. From where he stood, it looked like Tom was going for a gun under his coat. Remember, the last time any of the Earps had seen him, he was in Spangenberg's gun shop." Wyatt already had his long-barreled S&W American in his hand, and he wasted no time opening up. Not on Tom, but on Brother Frank, who Wyatt thought was the most dangerous man in the bunch. By then, Frank figured he did not have a choice and grabbed for his gun. Billy Clanton, young, scared, inexperienced, already had his gun in hand, squeezing off the first shot simultaneously with Wyatt. Wyatt's first shot struck Frank McClurry full in the stomach, while Billy Clanton's shot went wide. And there stood Virgil, like the Statue of Liberty, with Doc Holliday's cane high over his head in his gun hand. "Wait," he shouted. "I don't mean that." In his exposed position, who can doubt his sincerity? If the Clantons and McClory boys had time to look around, they doubtless discovered that Claiborne and Fuller had taken a powder with the first shot. Their whiskey courage quickly drained off. Frank McClory, mortally wounded, staggered past the Earps into the street, still clinging to his horse's reins. Tom, seeing that the fight had commenced, frantically tried to pull his rifle from the saddle boot, but the horse kicking and plunging with fright, broke loose and charged into the street with Ike Clanton's horse in close pursuit. Tom reached desperately after the horse, just as Doc Holliday squeezed off both barrels of that sawed-off 10-gauge. The full load of buckshot tore into his right side, ripping away the back of his arm and leaving a hole that could be covered by a man's hand. He stumbled off to die. The hasty exit of the horses left Ike Clanton exposed. He panicked, rushed up to Wyatt, grabbed his arm, and began to blubber that he was unarmed. That Wyatt lacked murderous intent seems evident in the fact that he did not shoot him on the spot. But with all the disdain he could muster, he shoved Ike away, telling him to fight or get out. Wyatt's cantankerous friend from Georgia was not so magnanimous. Doc apparently fired a couple of shots at Ike's fleeing backside, but with his wrist still aching from the kick of that 10-gauge scatter gun, his shots went wide. Doc would later live to regret that, but the Earp boys probably sighed with relief. Virgil had little time to think. Billy Clanton knocked him to the ground with a bullet in the right calf. Pulling himself up, he fired at Billy simultaneously with Wyatt and Morgan. One of them hit Billy in the wrist. He fell back against the adobe wall, screaming, "You're murdering me!" as he squeezed off another shot that staggered Morgan Earp as it slammed into his right shoulder and tore across his back, chipping a vertebra. Virgil and Wyatt fired again, and Billy went down in a heap. While Billy Clanton dragged himself painfully toward Fremont Street, Doc Holliday moved into the street, unaware that, miraculously, Frank McClory was drawing a bead on him from the middle of the street. At that moment, Morgan Earp stumbled over a water pipe and fell hard to the sidewalk. As he rolled over, he saw Frank McClory. "I've got you this time," McClory yelled as he fired. As he spoke, Holliday turned sideways to return the fire, and McClory's shot slapped Holliday's holster and grazed his side. Morgan Earp, still prone on the sidewalk, shot McClory in the side of the head. Incredibly, he turned and staggered across the street before he collapsed dead. By then, Tom McClory had reached the corner of Fremont and Third, where he sat dying at the base of a telegraph pole. Billy Clanton slumped against the building near the edge of the Fremont, trying desperately to reload his pistol. But the fight was over, no more than 30 seconds after it began. Citizens were venturing out of the neighboring buildings, and C.S. Fly, the photographer, took the pistol away from Billy Clanton, who was carried away to an upstairs room where he died, still screaming that he had been murdered. John Behan made a half-hearted attempt to arrest Wyatt Earp, who coldly told him, "You threw us off, Johnny. You told us they were unarmed." The wounded Earps were hauled away to a doctor to have their wounds treated, while the townsfolk gawked at the dead and regaled each other with opinions about what had happened as they meandered back into the saloons and business houses. Already, they were taking sides. At the hearing, held later, the four swore the Earps fired first, and so did Wes Fuller and Billy Claiborne. Wyatt Earp frankly admitted that he fired the first shot, but insisted that he did so because he believed the Clantons and McClurys were going for their guns. A dozen local witnesses testified to bits and pieces of conversation they had heard that day, and to vignettes of action that they had seen. The local newspapers took sides, and so did the local citizens. And every one of them believed that what they were saying was true. By then, what really had happened no longer mattered in any meaningful way. People had made up their minds before the hearing, and they were going to act on the strength of what they believed to be true. The fist-clenching, finger-pointing, squirming, posturing, threatening, and soul-searching of the participants and their allies were after-the-fact attempts at justification. Playing the affair over and over in their minds convinced both sides that the other was to blame and enabled them to rationalize their own roles in what has to be seen as a senseless affair. In their tortured efforts to explain what happened off Fremont Street, near the corner of 3rd, that October afternoon of 1881, lay the genesis of the OK Corral legend. Justice Spicer demonstrated his own version of Solomon's wisdom by making any sense at all out of the morass of testimony, and if he angered as many folks as he satisfied, they all had to be awed by his tightly organized narrative. More importantly, as tough it is for some latter-day experts to accept, he probably wrote as cognate of an analysis of what happened as anyone who has written about the fight since. You can quibble with some of his details, and sources Spicer never saw add useful and interesting facts. But in substance, his conclusions were correct. On balance, the Earps did have the best case, and Spicer did the only thing he could have done when he turned them loose after lecturing Virgil about his bad judgment and calling on his brothers and Doc Holliday to assist him in arresting the Clantons and McClurys. The actions of the Earps in the most famous gunfight in Western history was hardly heroic, but neither were they criminal. The street fight was a tragic, unpremeditated mistake precipitated by the empty boasting of one embittered, angry man. But then history often turns on such small, senseless things. If the Fremont Street fight did have historical significance, after all, it was only as a part of a larger conflict which seemed to threaten the peace and security of southern Arizona in 1881 and 1882. In that context, the angry miscalculations of October 26, 1881 gain a fresh plausibility and suggest the underlying forces at work in Tombstone more plainly the notions of murder plots among rivals in crime or of showdowns between law and outlaw. The emotions unleashed that day could not be recaptured, and they spawned a vendetta of such viciousness that the President of the United States eventually threatened martial law in Arizona. Even if the Earps represented the interests of respectable Tombstone businessmen, and I think they did, and the Clantons and McClurys were rustlers, as I'm convinced they were, the underlying economic, political, and legal issues which had been at stake in Cochise County were lost in a welter of hatred and violence that moved unchecked from that cold afternoon on Fremont Street until the day Wyatt Earp and his friends departed Arizona in the spring of 1882. Out of the rationalizations of that shoddy reality, the legend grew.